from pop culture to politics, this is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth, a great day for the President of the United States. At least he so believes. He's proclaimed it that. He's spoke together with Tim Cook, and this is a great event for the president because I don't think Tim Cook is somebody who's been noted as a prime conservative. He, of course, is the head of Apple, one of the largest corporate interests in the entire world. In fact, I think it may be in terms of valuation. It's right up there. I don't know how they compare to Amazon, but it certainly is one of the largest and most successful companies in the history of humanity. And Tim Cook, who is openly gay, which he calls attention to a lot, but he was there with President Trump and with Secretary Steven Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary. They were touring a new plant that Apple had opened up in Texas, providing needed jobs. And look, one of the points I know that Republicans should make and are making is that, yes, of course, these plants tend to go to Texas because the tax situation is so much better. One of the problems with a lot of the Rust Belt states that are suffering, which are more crucial states to Trump politically, of course, is that the tax structure is still not advantageous. Texas is one of those states. It is the largest of the states that does not have a state income tax. And yes, that makes the state far more attractive to business, and it might go along with what Trump is doing. What he's doing is trumpeting good news for the economy. He spoke a little bit when he was answering questions about the China trade deal. He is saying that they're still trying to work out at least a stage one deal. It would be wonderful if they did. It would be very, very good for the economy. And aside from the entire impeachment matter, I do think that the one way that President Trump could seal his likely reelection victory, and any honest Democrat has to acknowledge this, is that if he makes that trade deal, if the Senate goes ahead and does the right thing and ratifies the USMCA, the United States-Mexico-Canada trade agreement, the replacement for NAFTA, if he does that and the economy keeps growing, and it doesn't have to grow at 4% or 3%, if it keeps chugging along at 1.5%, 2%, if it avoids recession and the unemployment rate stays down, and the market stays reasonably healthy, if all of that happens, he's going to be very, very difficult to dislodge as president of the United States because people tend to vote their pocketbook. And especially if you're running against the likes of Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders or somebody who wants to blow up the entire economy, then obviously the advantage goes to President Trump. He made comments today about the impeachment. And okay, the first part of the comment's fine, but then he gets into attacking the fake news and the whole thing is a sham and the whole thing is a hoax and the whole thing is a witch hunt. Do we have the President of the United States? We will have it in about a minute and we'll play you the remarks that President Trump just made. By the way, it's interesting, when he started talking about impeachment, Tim Cook, who had been standing right beside him, the CEO of Apple, he kind of disappeared. He said, I don't want to take part in this. I knew. And I wish President Trump had more of that attitude. Honest to goodness, President Clinton actually gave him very good advice. And President Clinton, of course, beat impeachment. He not only beat impeachment, not only won resoundingly. I mean,
hot dog.
Yeah, hot dog is right. The Republicans in the Clinton impeachment, on all the three articles that they brought to a vote, the closest they came was 17 votes to removing Clinton. That's not close. Trump could maybe do that well, but not if he keeps talking like this. Here was the president when asked about impeachment at an Apple plant in Texas that he had just inspected.
It's a hoax. It's a disgrace. It's an embarrassment to our country. Nancy Pelosi has done a terrible job as Speaker. There's never been a Speaker that's done so little. And she's totally incompetent. And shifty stands up and he tells lies all day long. And even with that, so we have no due process. We can't have anything. And yet, not only did we win today, it's over. And some of the fair press, of which there isn't too much, said this thing is over. So the President of the United States told this guy, who's no, the question I ask, and it's the same question that a number of the congressmen have asked, why didn't he put this statement into his opening remarks? What's the most important statement there are? For this country, for our country, to be playing this, we're opening up massive apple plants. We have the greatest economy in the world. We have the greatest economy that we've ever had in the history of our country, of the best unemployment numbers that we've ever had. But we have a fake press. We have a phony press. We don't have freedom of the press in this country. We have a phony press. They're dishonest, most of them. We have some fine people, from fine journalists to reporters and companies, but most of them are fake and phony. CNN, NBC, ABC, CBS, The Washington Post, New York Times. These are fake papers. They're fake press. And they should be ashamed of themselves, and they hurt our country. And to be honest with you, I think it's a great tribute to all of those people in swing states and all of those people in this country. We had an electoral college, as you know, Congressman, we had a landslide, 306 to 223. We had a landslide. And they're trying to take it away because they can't do it fairly. But these are bad people. Nancy Pelosi's incompetent. She's nothing done in Congress. And now with their big star witness, this was going to be their star witness. Now, just so you know, I don't know him very well. He's a guy that got put there. He wasn't even on my side. He came over to me. I didn't even know that. He came over to me after I defeated other people. I defeated them all.
Anybody think this is brilliant? 1-800-955-1776. Here is the problem. What's the good outcome here? And by the way, in terms of the question, and it was a question that Ken Starr raised as well, why didn't Gordon Sondland put in that conversation with President Trump? Because that conversation was already a response to the scandal as it was unfolding. In other words, it wasn't during the time they had this mysterious hold. I believe the hold on aid to Ukraine had already been removed. It was removed very shortly thereafter. There was a Politico article about the entire matter and about the whistleblower. And very shortly after that, the aid all of a sudden started flowing. And the president had his meeting with Zelensky, the meeting that Zelensky wanted. And not just the phone call, but the meeting. And the idea that somehow Gordon Sondland was part of some great conspiracy not to put the statement in, that was something that Steve Castor, the Republican lawyer, the Republican counsel in the House Impeachment Committee, which is actually formerly the House Intelligence Committee, that he was asking about. What Sondland said is, look, his opening statement was 45 minutes. It was very long. It was very detailed. And he couldn't include everything. So he basically only covered that period of time where there was controversy going on. The whole thing was resolved basically by the whistleblower and by the idea that this would be made public. For the president to be attacking the press the way he does when he says they hurt the country, these are bad people, they're knowingly lying, I would ask on the president's part, same way that Gordon Sondland asked, what do you want? What do you want of them? And again, if he wants them to simply be sort of an organ of the administration, I think he got pretty massive coverage for his visit to Texas, which made him look good. And he went on in his comments to the press, as he does, about one of his potential opponents. Listen.
The Bidens is a whole different story. When you talk about corruption, when you have a guy that made no money, his father becomes vice president, and all of a sudden he's getting millions and millions of dollars from Ukraine, from China, from all of these countries. You just see two of them. This guy made nothing. He got thrown out of the Navy. He couldn't get a job. And then his father becomes vice president. And the press doesn't want to report it because the press is dishonest. So I think it's a disgrace. I think the whole thing with Biden is a disgrace.
This is obviously setting up the first question for Joe Biden on the debate forum tonight. And what's fascinating to me is I know there are leading Democrats who believe that, hey, what's keeping Joe Biden's campaign afloat is these constant attacks from Donald Trump. Because in terms of Democratic primary voters, I think that inspires sympathy, particularly when he's attacking President Trump's son. Not President Trump's son. That's another story. He has a number one best-selling book, does Donald Trump Jr. But Biden's son, Hunter, who has gone through a lot and is not a sterling example of achievement. It's Biden's other son, Beau, who tragically passed away from a brain cancer, that I think that Joe Biden's response to these attacks is going to be highly newsworthy tonight. Let's go quickly to Jim in Seattle. Jim, you're on the Michael Medved Show.
Yes. I think the great questions facing us are pretty obvious to some of us, even though there's a lot of distractions. The economy and the ecology, the environment, which isn't limited to only global warming. And I've called you before, but I think that there's only like center right to far right in the debate. There's really no real debate because you can't debate and mainstream corporate-owned media things like Marxism or liberation theology is what used to be and still tries to be in Central and South America. And so I'd like to make
okay,
that
so
point.
Wait.
I don't think...
Hold on for a moment. You say you can't debate Marxism, but again, do you think that is stopping people from coming forward? We have a number of very prominent people who we do discuss a lot who identify themselves as socialists, right? And there are increasing numbers of Americans, more and more relevant, who believe that socialism is a good idea. I take it that you do.
Yes. I'm thinking of people that are prioritizing the environment along with something other than capitalism. And I think it's a good thing.
Which socialist country do you think has this terrific environment?
Well, none, because there really are none left. I wouldn't say that Venezuela is socialist.
Okay, none left? Do you think the old Soviet Union did very well environmentally?
They probably didn't.
No, they did horribly. They had Chernobyl. You remember that? They had this nuclear meltdown.
Yes.
They had the most polluted air, some of the most polluted air in the world. China has the most polluted air in the world. It's still officially a communist country. Cuba is an environmental disaster. How about Venezuela? How are they doing down there?
Well, they're doing horribly, but we're giving them all the proper punishment that any country that even dares to try to help the poor gets, which is including now Bolivia under Morales, who shouldn't have been forced out. And
basically, if Evo Morales had been president of Bolivia for 14 years,
yes.
And the Organization of American States, they all concluded that the election had fraudulent elements in it. That's why he got forced out. And again, you assume that when socialism fails, it's always capitalism's fault?
Socialism doesn't get along with socialism. That's why.
At what point does a system become responsible for its own disasters?
Well, if it fails, you have to analyze why it failed. Now, What I am going to say is that if you read Counterpunch, the good website,
I'm familiar with Counterpunch, and I'm familiar with the Coburns.
They never get anyone on these mainstream, the MSNBC or CNN. They're never on there. They get recycled Republicans that are disaffected by how far the things have gone.
Okay,
the mining contracts is a big thing in Bolivia. In order to talk on this phone and receive those valuable minerals, and they wanted to nationalize. They did nationalize them so that they could help the poor out of their own country. This happens all over the world.
Okay, do you believe that the standard of living improved substantially under President Morales, the socialist Marxist president of Bolivia? Do you think that things got better there?
I think they have for the poorest of the poor. Now, I'm not an expert on that, but that was the intention. Anyway.
Okay, again, do you think that things have gotten better during the, 25 years of Chavismo, of Hugo Chavez and Nicolas Maduro? Do you think that things have gotten better for the poorest of the poor in Venezuela? They're starving today.
I believe they did under Chavez. Now, it is like a capitalist. Just not to change the subject, but how good is that you just declared Guaido the president? Now, what if someone wanted to do that in our country?
Okay.
Trump is ruining the environment.
Look,
the point
is that I understand that you come from a place. Can you give me an example of a heroic socialist regime that has done what it set out to do, where you think that, honestly, this example of Marxism shows the beauty of the Marxist system?
I have talked to you before about this, but dare I say something that Joseph Stalin, under his time in power, whatever he did wrong, there's a whole debate that's rarely ever accessed by people. But life expectancy doubled under him, and he defeated the right-wing Adolf Hitler, who would have just about ruined civilization in Europe.
You know, of course, that Adolf Hitler identified himself as a socialist. It's a national socialist regime. And Stalin initially had made a non-aggression pact with Hitler, which he had every intention of keeping hold of, except that Hitler, madman that he was, turned around and attacked Stalin. The idea that life expectancy had doubled in Russia, I guess that doesn't count the 25 million civilians minimum who were killed both in World War II and in Stalin's purges and gulags. The idea that you would point to, when I ask you an example of socialism succeeding, I thought you might bring up Mao, who now has been very credibly associated with 85 million deaths in China. These are some of the most nightmarish regimes in history, Jim. And I would suggest there's a new biography of Stalin. It's a 3-volume biography. They've completed the first 2 volumes. And you should check it out. There's another new biography of Stalin by Montefiore. And plus, all the books about Mao are worth checking out. I appreciate your call. And good luck looking for your socialist paradise. We will be right back with more on the hearings today, and also a local story up here in the Northwest, but it actually has national implications. It's about red flag laws and firearms. In other words, if a guy writes online, "I want to kill all women," and says that he's having a tough time controlling himself in wanting to assault and murder women when he sees them at shopping centers, are the police justified in taking away his guns? A judge has an interesting opinion on that. We'll get to that and more on The Medved Show.
More of Michael Medved in a moment.
The headline in the New York Times involves a case out in Redmond. Headline says, he wrote, "Kill all women" online. A judge let him keep his guns. He had actually posed holding 2 AK-47 style rifles with a caption that said, "One ticket for Joker, please." Not presumably at the White House. Let me go quickly to Brent in Marysville, Washington. Brent, you're on the Medved Show. Hey, Brent,
well,
you're
Michael.
On.
Hey, thanks, Michael.
You
yeah,
bet.
You called, you mentioned that you wanted people to call that thought Trump attacking the media was a brilliant move.
Yeah.
Yes, I absolutely believe that's a brilliant move. I think he's the fighter that Americans voted him in for, Americans like me.
Well, but what do you think? What do you think happens? In other words, he hasn't been at all shy about expressing his very specific tastes in media. I mean, he's even gone so far as to tell which Fox News hosts he likes and which ones he doesn't like.
Yeah.
What do you think that accomplishes?
Oh, I think it shows that he's a fighter, and what it also does.
How do you win?
How do you win as a fighter?
Yeah, because being a fighter is no good if you lose every match, if you lose every round. So how does he win in this fight against the media?
I've wanted a Republican to fight the media and call him out my whole conservative life. I mean, I've been a conservative since 1980, and I've followed you and other conservatives.
Well, thank you. That's the question. How do you win? Because the last president who made it a point to constantly take on the media was Richard Nixon.
Uh-huh.
And he had a vice president, Spiro Agnew, who was forced to resign. He had attacked the media a lot, but Spiro Agnew was forced to resign because he's taking bribes when he's county executive of Baltimore County, Maryland. The point about these attacks on the media, and by the way, substantively, I agree with what you're saying, and I agree with what President Trump's saying. I think there is tremendous bias in media. But
I've been that way my whole life. That's why I like it.
Okay, but do you think it's getting better or worse?
I think it's getting better. He's forcing them to acknowledge when they make huge blunders, and because he calls them out. I think there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, we live in a country where you can.
Okay, where do you think there is a huge blunder in the media coverage of this impeachment story?
Oh, the last 3 years of the Russia hoax. And they've carried the water for the left on that issue for 3 years.
I agree. I agree. I don't believe that there was objective treatment of it, but it worked out the Mueller report. In other words, do you believe that his constant attacks on Robert Mueller actually served to shorten the Mueller investigation or lengthen it?
Because that wasn't going to stop no matter what he did. So
I agree.
That's why I like him calling it out. Yeah.
But you see, the point is just calling something out. We live in a country where you probably recognize, I certainly do, that most people in the country aren't as interested in politics or as committed to one side or another as you and I are. Right?
Oh, I agree. Yeah. Oh, I know that. Yeah.
And I think for most people in the middle, particularly the idea of calling out specific people in the media and saying they're bad people, first of all, I don't think it's true. And it's also too general to try to, because the question is, if he says this is bad for the country, do you think that the president ought to do anything to try to shut these networks down? Organize a boycott or something like that?
Oh, no. No. I think it serves his point just to call him out.
Okay. And I actually think it makes the president look weak. But you and I are going to disagree on that. I appreciate your call, Brent, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. There's this story in the New York Times, and it says the authorities in the Seattle area came across an alarming photo on social media at the beginning of October. It showed a guy holding two AK-47-style rifles. The caption above read, "One ticket for Joker, please." Now, you probably know there was this whole madness. People were expecting somebody to shoot up theaters. Thank God nobody did. With only a couple of days left before the opening of the Joker movie, a law enforcement agency scrambled to assess the threat level of the message. As detectives waded through the man's online history, they encountered additional troubling posts. Charles Donnelly, who's 23 years old, talked about threatening his mother with a gun. and he described fantasies about hurting women. I will shoot any woman anytime for any reason, he posted on Twitter. Thanks to the state's new red flag law meant to help prevent gun violence, police in Redmond won a temporary court order to seize Mr. Donnelly's weapons from his home. He had three handguns and three rifles, including an AK-47 style rifle and its accompanying magazines. But a couple of weeks later, he returned to court with a lawyer, testified that his online posts were just jokes meant only for his friends, and he asked for his guns back. A judge agreed. And the judge gave him his guns back based on the fact that he had a First Amendment right to put up messages like kill all women. And there's other stuff. I mean, there's quite a great number of messages. I imagine that he will, I hope he will stop that. But this is problematic. I mean, and I think that it goes against the intent of the red flag laws. And by the way, the NRA and people who care passionately about Second Amendment rights have expressed some support for some of these red flag laws. I mean, if you can take guns away from people before they use them, when there's specific reason to be wary of those people or to prevent them from using the guns to kill themselves, it's probably a good thing. Facing a spate of calamitous mass shootings, including three in the last week in California, 17 states have adopted red flag laws as a vital new tool to seize weapons from people they deem imminently dangerous. But as more authorities rush to take preemptive action against a rise in gun deaths, they're finding themselves colliding with the Constitution and the limitations of those statutes. Judge Julie Spector, the chief civil judge of the King County Superior Court in Seattle, said these types of cases were the kind that could keep any judge up at night. She said that no judge has a crystal ball. We're going to be on the front page if we make a mistake, she said. Nobody is taking this stuff lightly. A week after the law was adopted, authorities turned their attention to a University of Central Florida student. This is the Florida's law. Chris Velasquez, who had praised mass shooters online, according to court records. Authorities described interviewing Mr. Velasquez and listening to him explain how he might carry on an attack with an AR-15 at one of his former schools. He described having urges to conduct a mass shooting. He told the officers he said it would take a significant life event to push him over the edge, but the police nevertheless used the protection law to temporarily block Mr. Velasquez from buying guns. And then they sought to extend the restriction. He challenged that, with his lawyer noting that Mr. Velasquez had no criminal record, had purchased no guns, and had given no indication that he would act on his comments. He got his guns back. Look, each case is individual, and it seems to me that people who are jumping on the idea that these laws are being undermined, not everybody gets their guns back, and the entire point of red flag laws is not to eliminate a danger, but to lessen it. We will be right back with more on the Medved Show. Michael Medved Show, a little while from now, the Democrats get together for their great big debate with 11 candidates up there. But there's one distinction. Now, Mediaite already awarded the moderators for the debate, and it hasn't even happened yet. But the moderators for the debate got a winner of the day from Mediaite, which usually does a pretty good job, I think, about offering winners and losers. What makes them the winners? Let me mention the panel that will be asking the questions tonight. Rachel Maddow, Andrea Mitchell, Ashley Parker, and Kristen Welker. The debate, it's President Trump's dream team. It's MSNBC and the New York Times are co-sponsoring the Democratic debate. So what do you notice about the four moderators? Rachel Maddow, Andrea Mitchell, Ashley Parker, and Kristen Welker. They're all female. Okay, this is outrageous. I mean, I'm not saying that any of them isn't qualified, and that's fine. But can you imagine in today's world if you had a panel that had four members and they were all white males? People would freak. They would be very uncomfortable with it. And why is it okay that it's all women? And you'll say because of the historic discrimination, et cetera, et cetera. The point is that double standards are a tremendous problem for the left. A tremendous problem for the left. One of the exchanges that occurred in the hearings today, and it's one of those exchanges that I think is also revealing about Gordon Sondland's murky testimony. They're just getting ready to gin up again at the hearings. Here is Steve Castor, who is the Republican attorney for the committee, speaking with, interrogating Gordon Sondland.
Did the president ever tell you personally about any preconditions for anything?
No.
Okay, so the president never told you about any preconditions for the aid to be released?
No.
The president never told you about any preconditions for a White House meeting?
Personally, no.
You said you didn't have your records or your documents from the State Department, but if you did, there wouldn't be any document or record that ties President Trump personally to any of this, correct?
Boy, I don't want to speculate what would be.
No, your documents or records?
I don't recall anything like
okay.
that.
Okay. No. Good heavens. Okay. Did the president ever tell you personally about any preconditions?
And again, the answer is no, he didn't. And at one point, there was a comments by Representative Jackie Speier of San Francisco Bay Area. And she said this, and listen to the audience reaction.
And I don't know why our colleagues on the other side of
the
aisle.
Is your lady yield?
No, I'm afraid I only have 3 minutes and I have some other issues, but thank you.
Well, the end of the article does go through that and also says it's three Pinocchios in spite of that conversation.
Well, the President of the United States has five Pinocchios on a daily basis, so let's not go there.
Okay, what she was responding was to Congressman Conaway had brought up that part of what Schiff had done in summarizing, it had been awarded three Pinocchios. He's gotten lots and lots of Pinocchios and earned them, it seems to me. There is, right out there for your entertainment delight, the number one movie in the country right now is a movie about cars. Well, it's not really about cars. It's about car designers. And it's not about car companies. It stars Christian Bale, Matt Damon, Ford versus Ferrari. Listen.
Now, it's time for Medvid on Movies.
Matt Damon and Christian Bale play two real-life car designers and sports car racers who accept an epic challenge back in the 1960s in Ford versus Ferrari.
You're going to build a car to beat Ferrari with a Ford.
Correct.
And how long did you tell them that you needed? 200-300 years?
90 days.
Well, despite the title, the movie isn't really about the two companies. It's about the two central characters, Carroll Shelby and Ken Miles, who have to please rising executive Lee Iacocca, played by John Bernthal, and the big boss, Henry Ford II, expertly played by Tracy Letts.
This isn't the first time Ford Motors has gone to war. We know how to do more than push paper. Go ahead, Carroll. Go to war.
Thank you, sir.
Do you think you can beat Ferrari?
We're lighter. We're faster. Mm-hmm. That don't work. We're nastier.
You ready?
I was born ready, Mr. Shelby. Hit it.
And the movie, despite running 2.5 hours long, can justify all the many trips around the track because it concentrates more on the human dimension of the interactions here than it does on the technical details of racing. Director James Mangold has done previous worthy projects like Walk the Line and 310 to Yuma, but this film is so well crafted that it will help get him the attention he has long deserved. One of the core problems is trying to keep a 24-hour race like Le Mans from making you bored or dizzy and filling in in some of the gaps about the Matt Damon Carroll Shelby character's personal life, which we see absolutely nothing about. Still, this is a superior and richly entertaining film, rated PG-13, for some tough language and scary scenes of racetrack danger. 3 stars for Ford vs. Ferrari.
For more movie reviews, go to michaelmedved.com.
And on the Michael Medved, we have big movies coming up this weekend. Frozen 2 and the Tom Hanks starring as Fred Rogers in A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. Speaking about a beautiful day, there's going to be a brutal night tonight with the Democratic debate. And why do I say that? I think they are going to get among the lowest ratings ever for a debate of its kind. And it's not just because it's on MSNBC and it has nothing to do with the all-female panel that is going to be asking the questions. All-female and all-left-leaning panel that's asking the questions. It has nothing to do with that. You know what it has to do with? Thank you to Adam Schiff. They just reconvened the impeachment committee. And they still have 2 witnesses that they're planning to question. So unless things go in a very, very different way than they have gone, they're going to be running right up against the Democratic debate. And which is kind of, even if you're a political junkie, even if you're a Democratic political junkie, aren't you more likely to tune in to the questioning and the whole impeachment committee process than to hearing Joe Biden answer questions about Boris Munn, I think you will be asked to, or the anticipated gang attack on Pete Buttigieg, who, according to some at least, is a new front runner, will be following the debate and the hearings, and will bring you all the latest and greatest and all the not so greatest tomorrow. Also, there's a movie star who's decided on the perfect way to promote his movie is to attack President Trump. I honestly, when you have a brand new movie coming out and it's one of the biggest movies of your career, you don't want Republicans to see it. You really don't want them to come out and see your movie. A claim is that President Trump has a bloody evil conspiracy to seize a third term. Okay, he has to win a second term first. There's more. There's also a new poll, and it's a Gallup poll, major poll. It shows that just about half of Americans want more government services. They do. They want the government to do more for them. But there's a catch. There's a condition attached. And that condition makes all the difference. We will be back with more. Everything seems to be happening, but maybe, just maybe, we can come to some resolution. And the resolution ought to involve actually the president inviting the Congress to get back to work, not just on the USMCA, the trade deal, maybe even doing something about the Dreamers. He says he wants to do it. Why not work out a grand bargain for the benefit of this greatest nation on God's green earth?